The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast, and I am very excited today to talk to Ajani Husbands, who is actually a former FSO and has a really unique story of how he left the department and set off on multiple different adventures and now finds himself in Africa. And I am not going to give away this story, but welcome to the show, Ajani.
Hey, thank you so much for having me on the show, Tanya. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, so you are actually, I think, our very first former Foreign Service officer to come on the show. So tell us a little bit about your career in the department and kind of the reasons why you left and what you did after that.
Okay, yeah, no, sure. Okay, so I started in the department as an FSO in 2007. I came in after grad school through the Pickering program. Let's see, so my assignments in order, I did Eritrea, then Haiti, Pakistan, and then South Sudan.
Garden posts, it sounds like.
And you know what I tell people? These were all actually my first choice.
I love that. Yeah.
With the exception, I mean, your first assignment is the, like, they give it to you. It doesn't matter. Sure. Kind of, yeah, they give it to you. But even so, like, they were all my first choice. So, like, starting in Eritrea, that was very interesting. And then in Haiti, I did a rotation assignment, consular, and then rotating over to commercial. But as a PD officer, you know, like, I hadn't had a chance to do PD work yet. Eritrea was political and economic. And so for my third assignment, I wanted to go somewhere where I could just learn as much as possible about PD work. And at the time, and I asked around, and at the time, it was generally considered that the most difficult place to go from a PD perspective was Pakistan, just given everything going on politically between the two countries. I mean, if you remember just some of the things happening, just, you know, in terms of the bin Laden raid and things like that. So that I said, well, that's where I want to go. Like, I want to go there and learn everything. And that I went there in Islamabad, and I actually met the lady who became my wife, who was the doing a PD assignment in Lahore. That was a great tour. And then
keeping it in the PD family, right? I'm a PD officer too.
That's right, exactly, so. Right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, we got to speak together,
right? Went from there to South Sudan, which was my PAO assignment, and I was the third PAO to serve in South Sudan at the time, the world's newest country. So I served under the first U.S. ambassador to South Sudan just before and then during the civil war that broke out. So this PD assignment that I had sort of all these grand designs for, and I had sort of like all this training and thoughts in terms of sort of like building a strong PD shop. An entire war broke out, and so most of the embassy had to get evacuated. So I spent a couple of months just doing evacuations with a team of people who did not leave yet. So,
and I mean, it sounded like you had a really interesting and varied career, and you got all your top choice assignments. So
I did.
I was even featured on. You to leave?
I was even on the cover of State Magazine.
Well, then you have to stay, right?
Right. Yeah, that's
something you can't leave now.
No, yeah, something you got to show the grandkids. Like, look, here I am.
No, but really, I mean, it sounded like you really enjoyed all of your tours. What sort
Yeah, no, absolutely. You know? I loved it. So a couple things. One, I loved my tours. I wasn't crazy about you're digging in and doing a lot of really good work and figuring it out, and then you have to go somewhere else and do something really different.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's the gift and the curse. Like, you get to do really cool, unique things, but then you have to go somewhere else and do cool and unique things. So I wanted to be kind of like a little bit more in one place. And also beyond that, just I wanted to be a lawyer. It was something that just sort of had been in the back of my mind for many, many years. I knew it was a path I wanted to explore. And I knew that if I did not pursue that path by a certain point, I would not go to law school. Like, I would not be a lawyer. So while in South Sudan, I applied to law schools, was able to get into NYU Law, got a really good scholarship. And so actually, it was a lot of fun. So I actually curtailed South Sudan, was supposed to do 2 years there, curtailed and went to law school, which again was a very fascinating time. And then
going from PAO South Sudan to, you know, living in New York City, I mean, it's a bit of a change, I would think, to attending law school and being a student, right? I mean, like, talk about night and day difference, right?
It was very different. And actually, I was in my early 30s at that time. Being a student again was a bit daunting. I made it out on the other side. I graduated and then went on to become a lawyer, worked in a few different law firms in the DC area.
Did you specialize in a specific type of law?
Yes. So corporate, in general, you could say sort of like corporate transactional work. I did a little bit of a mix throughout my time. So I did about 4 years practicing as an attorney at a big law firm. I did sort of like blockchain, fintech law for about a year. 2 years of capital markets work. That was the latter 2 years. And then at the beginning kind of started with regulatory law, but you can encompass it all just kind of under the corporate law umbrella.
Vague category of corporate law.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I'm curious, did you find that your foreign service experience helped you at all in your new industry?
A little bit. So one thing, I mean, just having already had a career, I was already pretty much aware of like if I was doing well on an assignment, if I was not doing well, or just like how to interact, just like how to set expectations, things like that. In my first year, when I was doing sort of regulatory law, something called the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and I did a lot of work on that in my first year as a lawyer. And that just being able to pick up that kind of law and everything that had to do with that was pretty easy just having been in the foreign.
Yeah, you
service.
Had a bit of an advantage.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny because I get the question a lot after, you know, I started doing real estate full time. Do you miss the service? And I'm curious if you found that when you were in law school, did you miss the foreign service?
A little bit, I'll be honest. A little bit. Like while I was in law school, because like it was still like so I was still so connected, right? Like like I had just now left. And so like even at one point, I had set up an event for the special envoy to Sudan and South Sudan, like at the law school. And it just felt like really good to be able to still do these kinds of events and
exactly all the connections and
it felt really awesome. But like, you know, eventually, you know, I let it go in a good way because I mean, like I said, I enjoyed it, but like I was really looking forward to the next phase,
to the next step, and never having to work on another EER again.
Never that. Like that's never that. Leave all that behind.
Yeah, nobody ever misses that part of it. Nobody ever misses actually the bidding, except for maybe first or second tour or the EERs. And I always tell people, I'm like, I am so glad. And, you know, it's always every year that season. And you can tell when your friends are like stressed out because they're like, I haven't done my EER. And I'm like, you know, I don't have to do that. It's really awesome.
Yeah, so. No, 100%. 100%. Yeah. You know, I mean, full empathy to everyone working on EERs.
Agree. Like, it is not fun.
Shout out to you guys. Yeah, man.
I know.
But not me.
Yeah. We're free. But then, okay, so let's go back a little. So you're in law school, you graduate, you start working for corporate law firms, you're working on a lot of cool issues, right? Mm-hmm. Like fintech, blockchain, stuff that has to do with foreign affairs.
Yeah.
And then what happens?
So a couple things there. So again, one, my wife is still in the Foreign Service. Like while I'm at these law firms, she was actually posted to DC doing a couple different assignments. So we were there for about 4 years, but inevitably we had to go, we knew we were going to go overseas again. So we actually got posted to Botswana, which is where we are now. And so one of the things, it sort of became, okay, this happened during the pandemic. Like we left the country in like around September of 2020. And it was supposed to be much earlier than that. But the pandemic, you know, at the onset, it slowed everything down. There was a backlog of just people who were supposed to PCS, supposed to leave, but just could not. So we finally left. And what this also meant during the pandemic was, I mean, as you know, everyone started working from home. Even law firms, which are traditionally like very sort of old school and like you have to be in the office, a lot of them really relaxed their rules. So I was able to work remotely at my law firm I'm from Botswana.
From Botswana. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. Well, you say that, you think that, but.
Well, I mean, I imagine you like sitting behind some like big mahogany desk, you know, like in some stiff suit. But I mean, I would think like working from home would be nice. No?
Well, I mean, yeah, in theory, you would think that. But you have to remember Botswana is like 7 hours ahead of East Coast time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the time difference. The time, I forgot about that.
The time difference. Yeah. So it really became
first world problems.
There it is, yeah. And also, you know, law firms, you're working a lot of hours, just like a lot
hours anyway. Yeah, yeah,
a lot
true.
Of hours. So it would be like I'd work like all afternoon through the evening, through the night, into the early morning, and then like would try to sleep a little bit, and then like wake up around midday, recover, and do it again. It was just very exhausting. It wasn't good for me, and it wasn't good for the law firm, to be honest, because. Mm-hmm. You know, neither side was getting the best of me. So, mm-hmm. Basically came to the decision, the law firm, at a certain point, they were like, look, are you coming back? No, not coming back. Like, I'm out here with my family. So just parted ways was how that ended. But then that opened up a new door, new opportunity, in that something that my wife and I have been looking at for a long time and kind of toying around with while in D.C., was this rum punch idea, this rum brand that we were doing. And that's another backstory.
Talk to me a little bit about how that comes about, because I don't think that I have ever had the idea of making a rum punch. So how does this idea suddenly appear out of nowhere?
You
visited somewhere, you enjoyed something. I feel like there's a story behind this. Because,
no,
again,
absolutely.
This is, yeah.
So yeah, so it's a lot of things culminating over many years. So one, my family is from Barbados, and one thing you should know about Barbados is that it is the origin of rum. That is, you know, the oldest known distillery of rum, Mount Gay Rum, is found in Barbados. So not just in Barbados, but the entire Caribbean, like, it's just rum is just a very important cultural piece. So growing up, like, it was always part of, you know, family, everything around me. And even by the time I started drinking, I just knew, like, well, if I'm going to drink something, it's going to be rum. So fast forward to my time in the Foreign Service, I remember in my second assignment, which was Haiti, my mom came to visit. She came actually for Thanksgiving and she came for Christmas. And she made rum punch. We invited some friends over. And she made some rum punch, like classic Barbados style rum punch. And everyone raved over it. They were just like going like, oh my gosh, like, is your mom coming back? Like, can like, this is the best thing I've ever had.
Is your mom?
Yeah, no,
the party?
Truly. Yeah, truly. Like, hey, Johnny, like, is your mom coming back anytime soon? Cause that rum punch was fantastic. So I was like, man, like, everyone really likes this stuff. So, you know, yeah.
So let me ask you, because I don't think I've ever had a rum punch. What's in a rum punch?
All right, here we go. All right, I'm going to give you two different things. So every kind of like island and region in the Caribbean like has their own type of rum punch. A lot of them are, a lot of recipes are very heavy in terms of fruit juices and mm-hmm. combinations of different rums, you know, like, and served in a punch bowl. The Barbados style rum punch strips all that away. And it holds true to the classic rum punch formulation. So punch being a derivation of the Sanskrit word panch, meaning five, okay? So there's mm-hmm. always just five ingredients in a rum punch, in a classic Barbados style rum punch. And here you go. Mm. And you can Google this.
Insider info there, people.
Insider, if you want. Yes,
can't have six, can't have seven, can't have two, gotta have five.
Exactly, it's less, not more, if you want a good one, all right. So five ingredients. You need rum, you need sugar, you need limes, you need bitters, and you need some kind of spice. And Barbados is nutmeg, okay? Mm-hmm. So those are the five ingredients, and you have to put them together in the right proportion. And so I started making my mom's recipe in Haiti, and I would just make like bottles and bottles of rum punch and just like take them. Like if I was going on road trips with friends.
Take to parties.
Yeah, honestly, yeah. Like if we were going, like just driving somewhere, going to an event. I'd make a bottle for each of us. Like, hey, everyone, like, this is your bottle for the festivities. Enjoy.
I think you and your wife are probably very popular guests to invite along to things. is it Johnny free? Oh, we gotta plan it around his schedule.
No, actually, I mean, I was so, like, I just really became, like, into just the idea of it, because just seeing the way that people interacted with Rum Punch and just never having had something that tasted so good in certain ways. Mm-hmm. It was so unexpected to them.
Sounds fun. Yeah.
It's very fun. Yeah. Like, it's light and refreshing. I mean, I go on for days about it. But anyway, so did that overseas and just kind of like, you know, kept making Rum Punch and working on it. When my wife and I were in the States, my wife said to me, you know, people like really like your Rum Punch. You should just try to see if like you can sell it. And she made some labels. Like, we're coming up with the name, and she made some like labels and bought some bottles. We came up with the name Bell's Bajan Brew. So,
ooh.
Yeah, all right, sounds really nice. Bell is my mother's nickname. She gave herself the nickname Bell after she
love it.
Yeah, after she became a grandmother.
Nod to mama.
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. Shout out to my moms. So Bell's Bajan Brew, and I remember we did a party. I think this was Juneteenth. We did a party, and like we just bottled like 50 of these in like just little 8 ounce glass bottles. Put them in a tub with ice, invited some people over for a party, and we're like, hey, just, you know, you guys want to try this? Like, here, like, party.
Here's the sample, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, uh-huh, party favors, you know? Everyone really liked it. And they're like, well, what are you doing with this? And I was like, well, you know, I was thinking of selling it. Would you buy? They're like, absolutely. Absolutely, I'll buy it.
Testing the market.
Yeah,
nice.
Exactly. So then the next step, just started selling it, just wherever I could, like, drive it to, like, in the DMV area. So I would just kind of like advertise to people like, hey, I'm selling Rum Punch. You know, I'll put it on my Instagram and friends would place orders. But then like, I knew I kind of had something when people I didn't know would ask, like they would send me a DM and say like, hey, I heard from—
Hey, can I get some of that?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like, I heard from Lauren that you're selling Rum Punch. I would love some. Can I buy 2 bottles? So like, we was heading that direction, and really like where I was looking, I was like, okay, well, this is getting really popular. I want to really look at like making this into an actual business where I can, you know, make it and distribute it on a larger level, as opposed to just like through Instagram, making it one batch at a time and like one bottle at a time and like getting out to people.
Yeah. Small batches. Can I ask, is there a competing product? Cause I don't think I've ever seen a Rum Punch bottle in the store, but then again, I haven't looked for it either.
Yeah. So fun fact, I'll say yes and no. I'll say yes, there are, but they're really hard to find and most of them are not that good. And I'll tell you why. Without sort of like naming brands, the major brands that you could probably think of off the top of your head, they have Rum Punch lines. They have mm-hmm. Rum Punch. I'm trying to think of an online liquor delivery, but like you can like type it in and look for it. You can order it. It's not that good. It has kind of like an artificial taste to it. Yeah, right. Like that's the issue. Like,
and is that in the processing? Like, how do you get that authentic taste? Right, because I mean, obviously, if you mix all this stuff and you're serving it, it's great. Because like, I don't even know, does it have an expiration? Like, if when you make it, like you have to put an expiration date on it.
That's the number one. It's the number one issue. So if you're a large company and you're making this, you need it to last forever, and you need it.
Correct.
To be
it needs to be on the shelf for 6-7 months, even.
Yeah, or years, honestly. And like,
or years.
Yeah, like it needs to be like in storerooms. It needs to be able to go anywhere and just like the definition of shelf stable. And so you're not going to use as many just raw natural ingredients because you just like can't risk it. And also, there's a lot that has to do with having color uniformity is a big thing. So the more—
What do you mean? I like to drink lumps and strange things in my drinks.
Right, who doesn't? Yeah. So yeah, but like,
what's this color? What is that?
No, the more you're using natural ingredients, the less likely you're going to have like a uniform, even, you know,
color. Yeah, for sure.
And then you do have like a couple of sort of like boutique brands that have, because like the RTD market, like ready to drink cocktails, that's getting very large in the U.S. right now. But most of them are using gins or vodkas. And only, I want to say last time I checked, there might have just been one or two that have any kind of Rum Punch. So like it's not very big. Yeah, it's just not very big, mainly because it's hard to do it in a way where you're using like fresh ingredients and have it like taste a certain way.
So when you were coming up with your formula, were you like, you know, mad scientist in your basement mixing all of these things? How did you come up with this winning formula that, you know, had that color uniformity and also tasted great? What was that process like?
So one thing I figured is I'm not going to go for color uniformity. I'm going to go for taste. I'm going to go for mm-hmm. just like, this is going to be the perfect taste and it's going to be natural. And even just like with where I'm at now with my manufacturer, it's a constant conversation of like, you know, your product tastes amazing. What's the stuff in your bottle?
It looks strange.
Yeah, like it looks strange. Yeah, exactly. And, yeah, and I'm like, well, you know what? Like that's, we're just going to deal with that with the customers. So I did a lot of experimenting with variations on the classic Barbados recipe, looking at different spices, different proportions, different ways of preparing the ingredients. And I would even like do like taste tests with my wife. Okay, now taste this, now taste that, you know, different things. I would send my mom different thoughts. And one time she kind of reined me in a little bit because I sent her one idea. I was like, hey, I was thinking of doing like X, Y, and Z. And she goes, you know, it's called rum punch, not rum soup. Like you can't just put everything.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh,
like,
ouch, mama.
I know. She was like, you know, you can't just put everything in there. Like you have to have some limits. Which, you know, like leave it to my
mom. You have to have some integrity, right?
Integrity.
Like, you can't just,
yeah.
Yeah.
So that was very helpful. And so by the time we moved to Botswana, I was pretty good on the recipe. And then by the time I started talking to a manufacturer who said, you need to give me actual measurements. By that time I had refined it down to like exact measurements to create it.
And how long did that process take from like the time that you started experimenting with the formula to the time you got like the exact measurements? And
yeah.
I'm just sort of curious because, you know, entrepreneurs, we're a determined, hardy
sort of
people.
Definitely.
And you work, you know, and sometimes people don't understand the blood, sweat, and tears that goes into making a product. Yeah. I'm curious how long it actually took you.
At least a year, honestly.
Wow.
At least a year. Because you got to remember, A, I'm working full time at a law firm, which, you know, eats up lots of your
not
hours.
Not a slouchy job either.
Right? Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
you're
yeah.
Working long hours too.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I'm kind of cheap. So like I'm buying to make it like the rum that I'm using, like I have to go buy from the store. It's like premium rum. I can't just buy like hundreds of bottles of this premium, like, you know, spending like thousands upon thousands for experimentation. So like I would like be very sparing in my experiments. And in between, I just did like a lot of research on flavor profiles and everything so I could figure things out before it came to the experiment time.
And how did you find your manufacturer?
So by the time we moved to Botswana, I knew that I had a product that people liked. And I knew that in South Africa, and we could say even like the region, the African region in general, there's an underappreciation for rum in the market. Or you could also look at it as alcohol companies, they undervalue the Africa market in terms of rum. They're not really sending out a lot of premium rums all throughout the continent. My wife and I have friends in South Africa that have random connections and random things. So we started talking to them. One of my friends actually said like, oh, hey, you should talk to my friend Maurice. He actually has a distillery.
Nice.
Yeah,
cool.
Right? And I talked to Maurice.
Power of networking and connections.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I talked to Maurice. I told him about what I was working on. He's like, well, send me a sample. So I had to like box up and mail a couple of jugs of rum punch from Botswana to South Africa, sent them to him. And one of the reasons I love working with Maurice was he's very, very technical. So, you know, I sent him the samples and I just kept bugging him like, have you tried it yet? Have you tried it yet? And he's like, he's asking like, what's all this stuff in there? And I was telling him, you know, because he had already signed an NDA, which, you know, like entrepreneurs, that's very important. Like before working with anyone, just like put together an NDA, have them sign it.
Non-disclosure agreement.
There we go. Non-disclosure agreement. So he's like, well, what's all this stuff? And he's asking me all these questions. I'm like, Maurice, will you just try it? And so then like he had like a bunch of other like distiller scientist friends over. And then he was telling me about it. And he's telling me like their thoughts and everything. I was like, Maurice, did you guys try it? What do you guys think? And in the end, he's like, we all liked it. Let's get to work.
Nice.
Yeah, I was all right.
Excellent.
Yeah, thank you. So like he really put me through the ringer. But I think it was a testament to the product because, I mean, he was really willing to, and still to this day, he's very willing to go out of his way for this product.
Okay, so you find a manufacturer. They like the product. What happens next?
So next, it's a lot of things all happening at once. So I'm also engaging with a designer who is another contact of a friend. So one thing that we learned sort of right away is that the words Bayesian and brew don't really have the same connotation, or just they don't invoke the same imagery in Southern Africa as in the States. So brew kind of like relates to beer. So, you know, if you put brew on there, people think you're selling some kind of beer product. And
they're confused. Right, yeah.
Exactly. And Bayesian is just, I mean, geographically, the continent is so much further from the Caribbean. So you're just not going to hear someone talking about Barbados. So they're not really going to know that a Bayesian is someone from Barbados. So had to like rebrand the entire thing. So engaged with the marketing team, which was through one of my wife's friends. They happen to have a marketing agency. And then talked to a designer. So everybody like all at once in terms of the rebrand. So like, what does the bottle look like? What are we calling it? How are we designing the label? Who is our target market? How do we reach them? When are we going to launch? How are we going to fund it? Like all these things are all happening at the exact same time. Over the next few months.
And at this point, are you still at the law firm or have you left by now?
At this point, no, I've left. At this point, I've left.
And you're like dedicating your time full time to this endeavor.
That's right. Yes. That's
okay.
Yeah.
Nice. So you're working with design, marketing. How did you determine who your audience was or who your target market was for this product?
Yeah. So the marketing team was really good. They did a lot of market research in South Africa for me. They had a lot of resources and I had sent them samples as well. So they were able to like kind of do some taste tests with people. But they'd also just done research on like who is drinking what and how are they drinking it. So they gave me good research on like what age groups are drinking different kinds of alcohol, trends in the industry. One thing about South Africa right now is that gin is very big. Like everyone's got a craft gin. You go into the liquor store, and I mean, in addition to sort of like the major international brands that you'll see for all kinds of alcohols, you'll see a lot of South African made gins, which on the one hand, it shows that, you know, like South Africa is very big into the alcohol industry. But one of the insights that I got was that, and this is a refrain I've heard over and over as I've been doing this, is that the gin market has become so oversaturated that consumers are really looking for something else. I mean, and that just played out in all the conversations that I've seen, all the conversations I've had. So that the research showed that there was an opening for something new. And a lot of research hinted that rum was the next thing. Mm-hmm. You would even see that like gin manufacturers in South Africa, some of them are also starting to come out with their own rum brands.
But that was just straight rum, right? It wasn't like a mix of other fun things.
That's correct. That was just straight rum. And now one of the issues, and this was why I decided to focus on, you can make your own rum brand. Like you can go that route. But one of the issues why I decided to double down on the rum punch, other than just like simply knowing it to be delicious, is that, is that a lot of people, and again, in the region, because they haven't really been exposed to rum, they don't know. Like they haven't had opportunities to do fun things with it. It's basically just like rum and Coke, and the rum that they've been given is a low end rum. Like that's when you go when you go into the liquor store, that's what's available. You can get a high end whiskey, a high end gin, high end vodka, you know, all kinds of price points for all those things. But if you want to go get a nice rum, not every liquor store is going to have one. They'll all have a low end one, right? So there's just like not been a lot of good experiences for people just in terms of drinking rum. But if you have something that's already mixed, a pre-mixed cocktail, and you've done all the work and all they have to do is pour it over ice, that takes out all the guesswork and you know and they know that they're going to get a premium product.
I'm curious how you determine price point. And especially, I mean, I think what's really amazing about your story is that not only did you put in all of the work, right, to like bring this product to fruition, but then you went and launched it in like a totally different market. Like you're just like, well, I live in Botswana and I'm going to introduce this to South Africa, right? It's like so foreign service in a way. It's like super international, right? It's like not even like I'm going to take on the US market, but I'm like, I'm just going to go into some other country and they don't have this, and I'm just going to, you know, work on this and bring this new idea to South Africa. I mean, like, what a great story. I'm very curious, like, after you do all this work, right, you hire this design firm, you look at the label, where do you price this thing? Is it, you know, because you mentioned premium, right? So yeah. I'm thinking this is sort of a higher end rum punch, because punch, sometimes people get the idea that like, oh, it's just like some backyard barbecue kind
of thing, exactly. Right?
That doesn't sound like what you're selling. So, and so that's why I'm also curious too, like when the people that you worked with for like the design and marketing, you know, kind of the target demographic, especially if you're doing like high end spirits, right? Like that's a very different consumer than me and my grilling on Sunday.
Well, the beautiful thing about this is that it's quality. It's such a high quality that, and that's what I call it, like it's premium quality. So you can have it with your very fancy dinner or like your grilling, like however you want to do it. But but one thing that we were determining,
versatile.
It's versatile. Yeah, but one thing that was very important early on, just like you're asking, is you know, like in terms of the audience and the price point. So I knew that in order to be able to really introduce this thing properly so that people would embrace it and love it the way that I do, is that it had to be made with quality ingredients. Like that was the first thing. And so even like with the manufacturer, like we shopped around, talked to a lot of different rum distributors, just little back story info on just like the alcohol industry. A lot of your favorite alcohol brands, they actually don't produce their own alcohol. They get it wholesale from a distributor, and then they take that and then they might further age it in their own barrels or run it through their own process. But that base alcohol, like that base rum or something else, they usually get from a wholesale distributor. So we were looking specifically at South African rum wholesale distributors. And the industry there is so new that it was very hard to find the right kind of rum. But when we found it, we knew it. And I mean, it was a very high quality rum. So that, plus the idea that we're using all natural ingredients, but then also
local products, sourced locally.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everything sourced locally. Because I really wanted to show that you could have this excellent quality product made entirely from South Africa, like from things.
That's
amazing.
South Africa.
But the other thing, the most important thing was because the rum industry was so nascent that I wanted to make sure that people engaging with this, that they would have an excellent experience from the first sip, no matter what, right? So I didn't, in terms of price point, I talked a lot about it in terms with marketing and with the manufacturer. I didn't want to price it beyond someone's reach, but also I didn't want it to be the same price as a low-end bottle of rum that you would get in the liquor store. So we settled on moderate price point. You would say like maybe like a middle income price point is what you would say, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
So to kind of like maximize the consumer reach.
And so then you have all this picked out, and then how do you launch this thing on the South African market? What do you do? And especially you're in Botswana too, right?
Yeah.
Like, so how does this work? I mean, not that that's a problem for foreign service people. We're just like, hey, we'll get on a plane. We'll do what we need to do, right?
Well, it's a problem during the pandemic where where like for a certain time while we were out here in Botswana, the borders were actually closed. So So I couldn't even get like to South Africa and whatnot. Like, so I did like the first few months of this was just like entirely remote. Fun fact, I only did one taste test of the manufacturer's version. He had run taste tests, and I was able to by that time the borders had opened up, but I was able to fly down to Cape Town where he's located, and I did a taste test. He had several different versions, and just a testament to how good he is, he had four different samples, and one of the ones I tasted, I was like, well, now this one is clearly mine. Like I knew like one of the samples, he didn't say like which ones of these were which, but one of them I tasted, I was like, well, this one has to be mine. Like this, this is like just really good.
Yeah.
And so then when he finally like revealed to me, it was like the one that I loved was actually the one that he made. That was like,
interesting.
It was like one of the
interesting
ones.
Interesting twist.
Yeah, it was one of the ones that he made. And it tasted just like you're just drinking sunshine. You know, it was just fantastic.
I love that. That's awesome. Drinking sunshine.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll sign up for that. Well,
yeah.
Hey.
But
sunshine in a bottle.
There it is. Yeah. So, but you got to remember, you know, I'd already poured a lot of money into this by this point and like moving full steam ahead. So most people like do the taste testing like first, you know, like early on.
You know, you make it work with COVID and, you know, travel restrictions. I mean, lots of people made lots of things work. So yeah, kudos exactly. to you. Right.
So just in terms of how do you launch it? So the marketing team had a lot of really, really good ideas. And I was like, look, I don't have the money for these things.
Well, I was just going to ask you, because I mean, you're working on this thing for a year, you're buying bottles of like really expensive rum, right? You're out all of this money, right? And you haven't even really made any sales yet. So that's a very good point. Like, okay, so you get to the launch and it's not like you can, you know, book out the Ritz or something. I mean, not that you would, but so what do you do? What do you do at this point?
So I want to say also on the funding, one thing I did that really helped was I did a Kickstarter campaign, and we ran actually one of the most successful alcohol-based Kickstarter campaigns in, you know, like in their history, because I ran through the numbers. Right. I'm very fortunate that it all worked out. But just got a lot of support from people in the States for the product, who just like really believed in the vision and the story behind it. So, you know, we had some funds. And so for the launch, the initial idea was that first we would focus on getting samples to retailers and like really getting them on board and just like try to get it in the stores and do more of like a slow, soft launch that focuses on just having it available in stores. But we missed a lot of deadlines, mainly because of supply chain issues, which is, I guess, that's a common refrain now.
Globally.
Yeah, right. Like bottles that were once available, like the next day, like, oh, sorry, there's no bottles. And then like the rum that we were buying, like all of a sudden, like, oh, the rum's not available this month. You got to wait till next month. So I just kind of doubled down. I was like, all right, like, well, we're probably going to miss on, you know, we're going to miss these deadlines with the manufacturers. We've got to get the name and everything out there. So just kind of talk to marketing. Everything's like, look, let's double down. Like let's just do a launch event in Joburg, in Johannesburg, and make it like a nice little party, a little event. Mm-hmm. And we will also invite influencers and retailers and lots of other people. So we did that. We had an event in Joburg, and what we did at this venue, at this restaurant, which had like an outdoor venue, we removed all of the drinks except for ours, which now is instead of Bale's Bajan Brew, it's now officially 1966. That's the name of the product, 1966. Mm-hmm. So we moved everything out of there except for 1966 and water, so that the only thing you could drink was like our stuff. And you know, we had like food, we had catering.
I bet people had a great time.
Oh no,
I was just saying.
So the thing was, I mean, that was another thing that just sort of signaled for me that this was something that people would want. People who I didn't know and didn't know me, they would come to the bar, they'd get a glass of 1966, and you would watch them take a sip at the bar, and their face would just be like, wow, what is this?
Yeah, nice.
And people loved it. So that was kind of like our launch, our soft launch. But one thing that I've learned and I'm still learning is that even though like right then and there you get interest from people, that doesn't always translate to sales.
I mean, commitments. Yeah, exactly.
So like, for example, we had invited some retailers to come, but like that weekend, like just a lot of them could not come. And then I think the one or two who did come, like we kind of followed up, and it's one, you know, as I've learned, like following up retailers is a long-term endeavor as opposed to hey, I like your stuff. You want to be in my store? Let me just buy some cases. You know, it's just a longer term process. That event was really good in terms of getting us exposure and affirming that people like the product, and affirming more information about the demographic and getting our toes in the water. And the other thing, we weren't even set up for sales yet. Like we were just like, it's a hodgepodge of things. So like, you know, people could not, if someone said, oh, I like this, like, let me buy a bottle right now. We didn't have any way for them to buy any bottles right then and there. And like, we weren't even set up through the manufacturer's website for them to be able to buy bottles. So I had to come up with a waiting list for people.
Oh, wow.
And then a pre-order list. And then the pre-orders was fine. Like some people like actually did end up buying through the pre-orders around like Christmas time. But by the time, it's like they put in their information in the system, and then a month later, I was like, okay, now here's like the payment information. You know, like half the people from the pre-order list were like, well, forget this, man. It's been like a month later. Like, I'm not, you know.
No
longer interested.
So lessons learned. Lessons learned.
One of the outcomes that we did have from the launch, we did get into a couple of restaurants. We had some restaurants.
Ooh, that were in our, nice. Yeah.
A couple of restaurant owners were very interested. They loved it. And then we did another like private tasting for another restaurant owner. And on the first sip, he's like, I'll take two cases, you know, for my restaurants. So we got into a couple of restaurants. But even then, it's not just getting into the restaurant. You have to be able to continue to publicize it and explain it to mm-hmm. consumers and do that. So like we got in, but we still just had a lot more work to do on maintaining that presence.
And building brand awareness too, right? I mean, because brand it's funny because my first, my first job out of college was actually for a fine wine and spirits company. And one of the top wines that was sold at that company, it was in California. Their strategy was they just did buy the glass, meaning they tried to sell it to every single restaurant in like all of California, because they figured if somebody went into a restaurant and they tasted it, they would be like, oh, where can I buy that? Right. And then word spreads, because that was their way of educating the consumer. So there's lots of different ways to do it. Right. And I think that's a really nice way of like getting restaurant owners who are always looking for something really interesting and new and different to offer, you know, their patrons that nobody else has. Right. So, I mean, there's multiple ways that you can, you know, attract attention. I think the hard part is keeping it up and continuing, right? So do you have salespeople or anybody that is doing that? Or is that you that you go to South Africa and you're talking to new retailers, talking to new restaurants?
Yeah, it's a combination between me and the marketing team. They're constantly reaching out to people. Like I said, it's a process. And you're exactly right. The consumer education, the brand awareness is a big thing. For the trade show, which was just for craft alcoholic beverages in South Africa, we were sharing a booth with our manufacturer, and they have several of their own products, and also sharing with one of their other clients. So there's like three like entities crammed into one booth. We got some like pop-up banners and did some flyers and some other stuff. We put stickers on these like really cute, like biodegradable plastic cups, like the clear ones that look kind of nice, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And just, we were at the trade show just hustling. The first day was for retailers, and the second 2 days were for regular consumers. And so retailers came by, you know, had never heard of this. Like, what is this? They tasted this, and like immediately, like, they're like, this is something new. I want to know more. I want to be in on this. I want to be in on the action. So got a lot of positive feedback on that. And then the next 2 days with consumers, which, you know, was for me the final validation of validations. I really wish I had like taken just like candid video of people's first reaction with the sip. 9 times out of 10, that first sip, immediately it's, oh wow, or like they give each other a look. You know, one guy's like, oh, yummy. You know, like just everyone is blown away.
That's awesome.
Yeah, people were bringing their friends by, saying like, man, you've got to try this. People from other booths were coming by, which is like a normal thing. Like you go and you look at, you know, check out the other booths.
Yeah, of course.
But they would try it and they'd be like, my God. And then like they'd send other people by from their booths, like on their break, like, hey, you know, Jennifer says I need to come over here.
You got to check this out.
This is great.
Excitement. That's awesome. And I mean, what a nice way of, like you said, seeing all of your work come to fruition, right? Because like all of the, you know, the time and, you know, the trials and tribulations and the money outlays, you get to a point where you're like, I can bring this thing that I've created, right, to other people and get to watch their reaction. Yeah, what a great thing to see.
Matt, let me tell you, there, you know, because it's like the trade show was like 12 to 9, like noon to 9 each day. And you're just like on your feet. You're like constantly talking to people. Your voice is hoarse. But when you take a step back and like you're looking and you're like seeing people like sitting at the like the bar space you've created. They're sitting there and they're chatting and they're enjoying this drink that you've made, like this product, and they're just having the time of their life. Like 100%, like that, it's all worth it. Everything's worth it because they are.
Yeah,
like,
no better feeling than that, right?
Like unadulterated. And like, and to be clear, like people will not drink it if they don't like it. Like they will tell you.
No, of course. Yeah. No.
Yeah, like.
I mean, it's a beverage convention. There's plenty of other things to drink there.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, I don't have to sit here and drink this. I could go somewhere else and drink something that I like. I mean, like people loved it. So we did really well there just in terms of direct sales on site, which was great. They'd come say, oh man, like, let me get two bottles. Let me get a bottle. Let me get this. Let me get that. So that was a very good introduction, like a reintroduction to the market. This was Cape Town, not Johannesburg. So like same country, but like two different markets that need to be worked on.
Well, that is a very far cry from the Foreign Service and maybe PD work in South Sudan. as we're wrapping up here, I'm sort of curious, what advice would you have for people in the Foreign Service who have an idea or who have a product? Maybe they have, I don't know, a salsa or something that they've made. It doesn't even have to be a food product, right? That they would like to test the market with. Like, what advice would you have for them?
Yeah, no. Don't skimp on research and research that you yourself do. I mean, you can never learn enough about your product, your industry, the thing that you're doing. I had a spreadsheet. This was even like before we left for Botswana. I had a spreadsheet of every craft company I could find in the States that was making RTD cocktails and what they were, what the price points were, whether anything was rum-based. And if so, whether anything was rum punch based, looking at the entire market. I did a lot of research on, you know, shelf life and chemicals and all that stuff to just try and figure out, can this even work or does this product need to be refrigerated? So for entrepreneurs, I would say like do as much research as you can. You don't have to be constantly putting your product out there to be making progress. Just reading up on your industry is work in and of itself. I'd also say, don't be afraid to take your time. There's no need to go from zero to 100 in one day. You can do a lot of work, a lot of prep work behind the scenes for months at a time to really make sure it's right. You know, don't be afraid to like get the opinions of people, you know, friends, family, but also outside of that. And then I guess I'd also say at a certain point, like just don't be afraid you have to jump. Like you just
got to do it.
You just have to do it. At a certain point, it just becomes like, I've got the salsa or the whatever. I'm going to just start selling it. Like there's no perfect time to do it. So you've just got to do it.
Awesome advice. Johnny, it's been wonderful having you on the show. Best of luck. 1966 artisanal rum punch. Maybe one day we'll see it in the United States.
That's the plan.
Best of luck to you.
No, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you for having me on the show.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll see you next time.